and welcome to Cellular Healing TV. I'm your host, Meredith Dykstra, and this is episode number 146. And we have Dr. Dan Pompa, our resident cellular healing specialist, on the line. And today we have a very special guest, and his name is Todd White. And Todd White is a wine expert, and we have a lot of fun things to talk about. This is not your average wine that he makes. So we're gonna talk a lot about wine today. But before we delve in, let me tell you guys a little bit more about Todd. Todd White has been a serial entrepreneur and creator since he was age 17. Today, after 15 years in the wine business, his life is dedicated to educating and helping people make better choices about food, nutrition, and how they think about consuming alcohol. He is the founder of Dry Farm Wines, a writer, speaker, and a leading authority on healthy, organic, natural wines and the importance of microdosing alcohol for health, longevity, and vitality. Todd's passion is unlocking the best way to enjoy alcohol, how to enjoy the benefits of moderate consumption while avoiding the negative outcomes. Todd has been a featured guest on many of the nation's leading health influencer podcasts, including Dave Asprey's Bulletproof Radio, Mark Sisson's Primal Blueprint, Abel James' Fat Burning Man, Rob Wolf's Paleo Solution, and Jimmy Moore's Livin' Low Carb Show. Todd is a self-described biohacker who practices daily meditation, Wim Hof breathing, cold thermogenesis, a ketogenic diet, intermittent fasting, and he is a fitness enthusiast. He's also a frequent speaker on the ketogenic lifestyle and is completing a cookbook on the ketogenic diet and lifestyle to be released this fall called Keto Well. He was most recently the featured ketogenic speaker at the 2016 Bulletproof Annual Conference on Biohacking. He lives in Oakville, California, in the heart of Napa Valley wine country. Welcome, Todd White, to Cellular Healing TV.
Awesome. Hey, guys. I'm just super excited to be on your show today. We have a lot of fun stuff to talk about, and wine is the topic.
Man, I tell you, we have sure much in common. I mean, think about it. Intermittent fasting, ketosis. I mean, we could do a three-hour show, I think, and just keep rocking it out. But today's topic will be trapped and forced into wine. Not really. That's probably my favorite subject. I mean, gosh, we would get to talk about wine on Cellular Healing TV. But yes. I can testify to your product personally. I can already testify to many of my clients who are not able to drink wine. And I said, try these. And they were able to drink wine. So you have already made a lot of people very, very happy. So let's tell people why that is. What's the difference with these wines, Todd?
Well, I can't wait to get into the wine thing. Hopefully we'll get not only, but just a couple of moments on ketosis and also my favorite topic of the moment, which is intermittent fasting. And I know you and I have talked about, we just eat too much, too often, and the wrong things. But before that, let's get right on to wine. So yeah. I kind of came down this path. I've been in the wine business for a long time, and as I got deeper into biohacking over recent years, and I've been ketogenic for the last 3 years, what happened next was I just found I could not drink traditional wines anymore. And so what I'm going to have to do here, because I'm at my office today, this is kind of a crazy thing,
nice.
But there's some beeping out in my warehouse. I'm just going to move rooms while we're talking here. Real quick.
Well, oh, I thought we were going to go on a tour.
Looks like it's going to calm down now. So, anyway.
You could show us where the wine is, though.
Yeah, the warehouse is actually right next to me in a separate building, but we're kind of adjoined. And so it's kind of noisy there for a second. But looks like they've calmed down. All right, back to the wine thing.
That was the truck backing up. Beep, beep, beep.
It was the truck backing up, actually. There's a huge, huge truck here making a delivery. So, anyway, but hopefully they'll get settled down back there. So when I got where I couldn't drink traditional wines anymore, and so I started biohacking and kind of unpacking what was going on with wines. Initially, I thought it was just the high alcohol, and we'll talk about how and why alcohols are higher in commercial wines today than ever. It's both a winemaking style as well as it's being fueled by irrigation in the U.S., but we'll cover that. But I thought it was mainly the higher alcohol. Well, so I started dosing down on alcohol, which was effective, but then I discovered the natural wine movement, which is really exploding in Europe. There's very little right. natural wine made in the United States, and we'll define what natural wine means, because most people think, well, you know, isn't all wine natural? But in fact, It's not. And I'm going to cover all those topics for you. But so when I discovered natural wine and got rid of all the additives and toxins that are in commercial wines today, in addition to dosing down the alcohol, I discovered that I could drink wines again. And this is what many of our customers also discover. And you've probably, Dan, you've had this experience, right?
Or,
I mean, you've had the experience with our wines. They literally make you feel different. And you don't have the negative repercussions. Yep. What's been your experience?
Yeah, no, just that. Top of the show, I said that I've had many clients who are not able to drink wine. They're neurotoxic. They're very sensitive. And they're able to drink these wines. So again, what I have found personally is I can drink a lot more of this wine. No problem. Feel fine. Right? And of course, we're going to discuss why that is. But there's a couple reasons why that is. So, I know these wines are also, as we're going to talk a little bit about ketosis, they're keto approved, which could be one answer why. There's no sugar in it, but I think there's other answers too.
They are. So all of our wines are sugar free. And in fact, we do independent lab testing. And even the king of keto, Dr. Dominic D'Agostino, who's the leading ketogenic
researcher. He just spoke at our seminar. He's been a guest on the show. Yeah, 2 weeks ago, he was at our seminar in Vegas.
Yeah, so awesome guy, and in fact endorses our wine product, and he's done independent lab testing with in his own lab and at his house with blood testing on our wines, and has recently posted and endorsed what we do as ketogenic wine. But let's talk about what makes a wine natural. So let's start with farming. So natural wines are always organically or biodynamically farmed. Biodynamic farming is just a prescriptive of organic farming. So it's an advanced form of chemical-free farming. So all natural wines are chemically free farmed or biodynamic. They're also dry farmed. What that means, just like our name, what that means is that the wines have no irrigation. And the reason that's super important is because irrigation fundamentally changes the physiology of the plant, and most importantly, how fruit ripens. And so what happens at the end of the ripening process is that when a fruit is filled with water, having been irrigated, is that the character of the fruit is not as well developed, and the phenolic flavors don't develop correctly at the ripening process. And what that means is that the fruit has to be picked later in the ripening process with higher sugars. And what higher sugars create are higher alcohol and higher sugar byproducts like glycerol, right? So important to have organic, chemically free farmed irrigation. Let me give you an example of what irrigation does to a vine. So when you irrigate a vine, it gets all of its nutrient and all of its water right from the surface from a little drip hose just above the trunk. Right? So the root ball of an irrigated vine is about 3 feet in diameter and about 3 feet deep, where an unirrigated grapevine at maturity will have a root structure that can range 30, 40, 50 feet deep as that vine struggles in search of water and nutrients. Right? So it's struggling against its neighbor, it's struggling against nature to feed. This creates a fruit with much higher character, right? So this is a reason in most of Europe, almost all of Europe, it's against the law to irrigate a grapevine. In fact, irrigation did not come to the United States until 1973 for grapevines, right? Now, why do you irrigate a grapevine? Why do American vintners irrigate a grapevine? Because it creates a higher yield and the fruit weighs more. It's filled with water. Right? Fruit is sold by the ton. So if it weighs more, then it's more profitable. So just like with most of agribusiness, the industry has consolidated, and the goal and the objective of corporate consolidation is not to make better, healthier wines, it's to make wines cheaper and faster.
Always.
Right? And so this has happened all across our food and everything that we grow. This has been a massive, massive problem driven by corporate America. To give you an idea, in the American wine industry, 52% of all the wines made in the United States are made by just three giant companies. Now, you don't know that, and they don't want you to know that. It's a multi-billion dollar operations. So they hide behind thousands of brands and labels to have you believe that you're drinking from a small farmhouse or somebody's chateau, when in fact you're drinking from massive factories.
Yeah.
And just to take that one step further, 70% of all the wines made in the United States are made by just the top 30 companies. Mass consolidation of the industry. And what happens with mass consolidation is we're working on spreadsheets. We're not working on your health, right? So that, again, the goal is to make wines faster and cheaper, not healthier or better. And how do they do that? Well, first of all, they use a whole bunch of chemicals, mm-hmm. right? So what's little known to your listeners or anybody who hasn't heard a podcast or read an article that we've written about this topic, because this is the big, dirty, dark secret of the wine industry. There are 76 additives approved by the FDA for the use in winemaking. Of the 76 approved additives, which your audience has no idea that these additives even exist, they think wine's fermented grape juice. But in fact, it's not. Of the 76 chemical additives that are approved by the FDA for the use in winemaking, 38 of them include the acronym GRAS. You and I know that stands for generally regarded as safe. So the FDA is telling us that half of these additives, it is safe, right? Now, here's the reason your audience doesn't know these additives. Because there's no contents or nutritional label on a bottle of wine.
Right.
It's the only major food product without a contents label on it. Now, let me tell you why it doesn't have a contents label on it. If it did, you know, the contents label would be like this big, you know, with a bunch of names you couldn't produce, you couldn't pronounce, right? Just like you find in food products today. Because wines are filled with preservatives and additives and adjustments, right? To make them snackable and drinkable and to make you want to crave them more, right? Right. So these additives... The reason that there's not a contents label on the bottle of wine is because the wine industry has spent tens of millions of dollars in collaboration with the government to keep wine labels off of wine. Now, if it were just fermented grape juice, why would they care if there was a contents label on it? Because it's not. And that's what they don't want you to know. So natural wines contain zero additives. They are also fermented with native yeast that are indigenous to the vineyard where the grapes are grown. Commercial wines are inoculated with genetically modified commercial yeast. So the very first thing a winemaker does when a standard wine is made is they use sulfur dioxide to kill the native yeast, right? So that they don't ferment. And then they inoculate the juice with a commercial yeast. And we don't know what the health ramifications of these genetically modified yeast are. We just know that when wines are fermented with native yeast and additive-free, they don't contain any of these problems commonly associated with drinking wines.
Yeah.
Right? So we're talking about native yeast, no additives, no adjustments, organic farming, and biodynamic practices. So this is what makes up a natural wine. Right? Again, only less than 1% of wine made worldwide is actually naturally made. So we're talking about this permeation of additives and adjustments and manipulations to wine are spread globally. I mean, they began in the West. They began here in America. But it's really a global problem now.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a few hundred thousand winemakers worldwide. Less than 500 actually make these natural wines.
Yeah, it's hard to believe.
It's just crazy. Well, I mean, here we are trying to protect our health, trying to really be aware, and listening to folks like you and other health influencers who are really doing amazing work in educating people about how to live a healthier, longer health span. I know you and I have talked about this before. You know, the goal is really health span, not lifespan.
Right.
Right? We want to be healthier longer.
Yep.
right? And so your listeners and my followers and the folks that we associate with and live with are super concerned about what they eat and drink. And we try to eat whole and fresh and clean and organic, but then nobody's really telling us about what we're drinking. And most of your audience enjoys imbibing in alcohol, as do I. But I want to take the same approach toward wine or alcohol consumption that I take toward everything that I think about consuming.
Well, two things. There was just a study going around talking about how one or two glasses of wine is actually good for our microbiome. However, you add 76 additives and other, chemicals, who knows, right? Higher alcohol contents. And I think we go against what we know is true about wine. A little wine is, from the antioxidant values to the fermentation, what it does for our microbiome, I think we're just learning, has all types of benefits until we, screw that process up. European wines, no doubt, we see that benefit to the microbiome as opposed to the U.S. wines. So obviously, European wines, one thing you pointed out was, number one, is that it's illegal to use irrigation. So they're getting a better fruit, obviously, a better product even to make the wine with. They're not adding the additives, evidently. Some do, though, right? But if you're going to find natural wines, you're going to have to go to Europe. Am I right on that?
Okay. Substantially, most natural wines, 95% are produced in Europe. That does not mean all European wines are natural.
Correct.
So there's a very specific category. We're the largest reseller of natural wines in the world now. And so if you were to buy wines from us, you're going to get a lab-tested natural wine that is in.
That's where I was headed next, because you have a criteria, because, we risk it. Oh, natural wine, we order from them. However, we don't really know, do they have sugar or not? We really don't know that. You do. You test them. So talk a little bit about that testing. And one of the things you look at, too, is the alcohol content, because real wine – really has a lower alcohol content that we're finding in the U.S. They're probably just the U.S. wines, the Napa wines, people like the higher alcohol. So that's probably part of it. But talk about your criteria and talk about your testing, because really that's why I want to buy wine from you, Todd.
Right. So we have a very specific testing protocol. So we're looking at alcohol. We're looking at sugars, because I'm sugar-free. I want to drink wine that's sugar-free. Consequently, it's virtually carb-free, because the carbs in wine are coming from sugar.
Right.
So we're also looking for mycotoxins like ochratoxin A. There is no screening in the United States. This is really interesting, because quite a few of your audience, and there are a lot of folks in the health movement who are concerned about molds, right? And quite a few people who have allergies to mold. And so all of our wines are tested for ochratoxin A, which is the primary mold found in grape farming. The problem in the United States, there is no screening for ochratoxin A. It is not required by the government. Now, you can get it screened. You can lab test a wine for ochratoxin A, and it is required if you're an American wine producer and you export to Europe and other parts of the world. They actually require that you submit an ochratoxin A report as a part of your export lab reports,
huh.
Right? But our government doesn't require that we look at it here. So we're also screening for molds. But here's the interesting thing about alcohol. Let's talk about alcohol for just a second, because alcohol is a toxic. It's a toxin. It's poisonous, right? So is water and oxygen in the wrong dose,
mm-hmm.
Right? So dosage really matters in everything that we do. And the reason we talk about microdosing alcohol. But let me talk about, once again, the government and their collaboration with the wine industry in not being honest with the public.
Mm-hmm.
When you get an American bottle of wine and it says 15% on the label, which is quite common, alcohol levels have risen in wine over the last couple of decades, both as a result of irrigation and as a result of winemaking styles. Right? So Americans typically, historically, want bigger, bolder, bigger, right? In everything. We just like big, right? So including alcohol and this boldness of taste. That's not how real wine tastes. A real wine doesn't have that kind of alcohol level in it. So remember, alcohol is the alcohol, the resulting alcohol in a bottle of wine will be determined by the sugar level in the fruit at the time of picking. So the higher the sugar caused by irrigation, the higher the sugar, the higher the corresponding outcome of alcohol will be. So American wines now, or domestic wines, commercial wines, you're typically seeing 14.5% to 16.5% alcohol stated on the bottle. Now, when I say stated, what that means is that the alcohol, the wine industry, is back in bed with the government. And the government has allowed the wine industry to be dishonest with you. What I mean by that about alcohol is that what's stated on the bottle by law is not required to be accurate. So if a wine says 14% on the label, legally, it can be as high as 15.5%. So the wine industry gets up to 1.5% to mislead you about how much alcohol is in it. Now, the reason that happened is because that law was written back in post-prohibition era, when the testing methods for alcohol were not as accurate as they are today. But there's no reason for that to remain on the books today, because the lab methods for measuring alcohol are extremely accurate today as technology has evolved. But again, the wine industry wants to keep that so they can fudge and tell you that there's a lower amount of alcohol than is actually in the bottle. Yeah. And the reason that matters is because here's what we want from alcohol. All right, so you can drink spirits. Let's talk about just drinking in general for a moment. You can drink spirits, and we're talking about a 40% dose of alcohol, right? So spirits are clean when they're distilled. So in the paleo movement, or many people say, you know, you should drink tequila. It's plant-based and it's distilled, so it's clean. And I agree with all that, except that the alcohol dose is simply too high, mm-hmm. right? You're talking about 40% alcohol. Then you can go to traditional wines, which are 14 to 16, 17% alcohol. Or you can go to beers, which are strictly out for me for two reasons. Yeah, sugar levels are too high and the gluten levels. But even if it's gluten-free, your sugar level and high, your sugar level is very high in beer, right? Which is why you have the beer gut. We know that's insulin response. But so it leaves me with, how do I get a responsible dose of alcohol to achieve the following effect? So when I drink, which I only drink at night, generally around the dinner table, we don't drink in the daytime here. I don't recommend people drink during the daytime for a whole host of reasons.
We fast.
What's that?
I said, we fast during the day. We don't want to drink that. We want to drink
exactly. So here's the benefit of alcohol and how alcohol is just super positive and an amazing drug, right? Here's how it's positive. We're around the dinner table. We're going to have a lift of euphoria, you know, a brightening of creative expression. We're going to have a little lowering of our vulnerability window, which allows us to know one another better, right? Which allows us to bond. This is the reason that people, you know, drink with their buddies and they have these kind of bonding experiences, right? So we made ourselves a little bit more open and available, right? It also helps to settle our monkey mind, right? Which I recommend meditation for that first and foremost. But, you know, it's going to help settle us into that kind of community around the table when everything else just kind of melts away. And that's a beautiful thing.
It is.
And that's particularly beautiful when we're with people that we've just met. I was at a dinner party last night with about 20 folks around a large table, and about half of them I didn't know, right? So this is an amazing experience of community and sharing and really love and opening up and elevating euphoria. And that's what's terrific about alcohol. The problem is when we cross over the other side of that plateau, now we're losing cognitive connection. We're losing creative expression. We're losing that sense of community, and now we're into a place of oneness, right? And so that's what we want to avoid, and that's the reason it's super important from my perspective to dose down the amount of alcohol that you drink. Now, so if you're like me and most people, including the people I was with last night, I'm not going to drink a glass of wine. I'm going to drink several over the course of the evening, right? So I want to start with a lower alcohol product that allows me just to drink a little bit more, enjoy it longer, and frankly, lower alcohol wines taste better with food. Alcohol and food don't taste great together. well-crafted wine and food taste well together, and it brightens the expression of food, but we've got to keep the alcohol level down, which is the reason we don't drink anything over 12.5% alcohol. And most of the wines I drink are 11%. Mm-hmm. So I just prefer the taste of a lower alcohol wine. It allows me to drink a lot more of it without any of the negative effects. I mean, I know you've had that experience with our wine.
Yeah, no doubt about it. You know, being able to drink more of it allows you to benefits. Really, what's you know, because you're getting more of the benefits without the drawback. You know, when you're way hydrated, you know, in the morning and at night, it's the alcohol. You know, it's the over alcohol that's dehydrating. When I drink your wines, I'm not getting that. I'm not getting that dehydration that I hate with regular wine. So, I mean, there may be other reasons for it, but I would say the alcohol is probably the number one reason related to the dehydration. So what are some of the other things you test for? I mean, you talked about the mold, the number one mold in wine. You talked about, obviously, the alcohol level. I'm sure you're looking at certain additives. What else you have?
Well, we're also doing random screening. We don't screen every wine for glyphosate, but we just don't find it. As you know, there was a study done last year with three American wine appellations showing 100% contamination with glyphosate in all of the wines tested, both from organic and non-organic farms across three appellations. The reason it's speculated that glyphosate is getting into American wines, this is a really interesting concept, is from the irrigation.
Yeah.
Because the way Roundup is applied is different than the way it's applied in other farming practices, which can be applied by plane or, you know, with large shares. In a vineyard, it's applied very close to the ground in a very narrow spot just underneath the grapevine. The way it's applied doesn't really afford the opportunity for overspray. And so when you're seeing glyphosate found in American wines on organic farms where it's not being used, how did it get there? And the most recent speculation is that it's coming in through irrigation. And so that's obviously because our wines are dry farmed. And as I said, most all of Europe is illegal. It's illegal because the Europeans who've been making wine for about 3,000 years, the reason irrigation is illegal in Europe is because the Europeans know what I know. The moment you start irrigating grapevine, you change the fundamental character of its fruit. And so in order to protect the appellation and the quality and so
froze up there for a second.
Asked you for a few seconds there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So yeah, the last thing I heard was you changed the fundamental character of the fruit.
Right. So this is the reason that irrigation is illegal in Europe is because Europeans who've been making wine for 3,000 years know what we know, is that when you change to the fruit, you change the quality of the wine.
Yeah.
Right? And so in order to protect their brand quality, that's the reason it's been made illegal. But we're also not seeing this glyphosate issue in Europe the way that we see it here.
Well, let's have the obvious conversation, the sulfite, you know, conversation that so many people know. They blame the sulfites on everything. Now, again, there's a difference in the level of sulfites. Every natural fermentation process is going to have them. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So sulfites is another element that we test for. So sulfites are naturally occurring in all winemaking, right? Whether you add additional sulfur dioxide, which is used as a sterilizer and a preservative by most winemakers worldwide, including excessive amounts in commercial wines, so that they sterilize the wine so that they create this shelf kind of consistent, every bottle tastes the same just because we've kind of sterilized it. But let's talk about sulfites and what's making most people feel bad when they drink wines, and it's particularly inherent to how red wines make people feel, right? It's not coming from the sulfites. Here's what we know about sulfites. White wines are higher in sulfite than red wines, right? And so we know, and most people experience wine problems with red wines, although with me it was historically just the opposite. I couldn't drink white wines, and the primary problem was the sugar level. So if I drink sugar, it gives me a headache, right? Because I'm not accustomed to it. And so,
I'm exactly
right. Right. So, but our white wines are also sugar free. We test for sugar on every single wine, in addition to sulfites. So we place a cap on sulfites in wine at 75 parts per million. Now, the U.S. limit allowed is 350 parts per million. We place our cap at 75 parts per million because naturally occurring sulfites can be as high as 75 parts per million. Although I would tell you most of the wines that we sell and test are under 30 or 40 parts per million, and many of them 5 to 10 parts, right? Because they have no added sulfur dioxide. Now, what sulfites do to a wine, we don't believe for most people, unless you experience a legitimate sulfite allergy, and for those people, they're walking around with an EpiPen in their pocket because sulfites are contained in many foods.
Yes.
Naturally occurring and added, right?
Yes.
But most people don't genuinely have, it's less than 1% of the population has a sulfite allergy, right? But what sulfites do is when they sterilize the wine, these huge doses of sulfur, it removes the soul and the character from that living, beautiful, soulful juice, right? It just sterilizes it. It makes it just a shelf consistent, every bottle tastes the same. That's not how real wine tastes. Real wine has soul and character and it's alive.
Yeah.
Right. That's what real wine tastes like. So here's what's making most people feel bad when they drink wines. It's not the sulfites. It's generally these biogenetic amines like tyramine and histamine. And those are exaggerated in commercial winemaking practices because of the way wines are made now. And so you just inherently have a higher histamine and tyramine level. And that's generally, this leads to tightness and tension just in the forehead. It leads to, for some people, spotchiness or redness or feeling of warmth that's unnatural. These are biogenetic amines that are really at work. Like I don't have a particular sensitivity to histamines, but if I drink commercial wines, I can feel it right here in the front, right in the center, just above my, that's tyramine and histamine. Right, and it gives you that tightness in the head, a bit of just a tightness. That's really unnatural. You don't get that from natural wines.
Yeah, well, no, exactly. And I try to explain that to people. So hopefully, having this show, you being the expert, you'll get it across to them. Meredith, I know you have some questions, so I'm gonna turn it over to you.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, I'm glad because I was going to ask them, you just answered it, what people are mostly reacting to. I think that's great. Can you talk a little bit more about the yeast, though? I'd like to understand that a little bit more.
Well, let's talk about how wine is made just real quickly for your audience who may not be familiar. I have to plug in my computer here. Who may not be familiar with how wines are made. So, because people, this is the most common question that I get when I travel around the country, and we sponsor all of these. We're the official wine for most health conferences. And people most often ask, well, how can a wine be sugar-free? Doesn't it have sugar in grape juice? Isn't it filled with sugar? It's like, yes, and this is how it becomes sugar-free. So this is how you make alcohol. When you inoculate the fruit juice or anything with sugar in it, potatoes, or you can make alcohol out of many things, but let's just talk about wine for a moment. When you inoculate the grape juice with yeast, the yeast eats the sugar, right? And as it eats the sugar, the byproduct of that is carbon dioxide and ethyl alcohol, right? And so how a wine becomes sugar-free is when the winemaker allows the fermentation process to complete and the yeast eats all of the sugar. Now, what's happening in commercial wines is that the winemaker, again, is using sulfur dioxide to kill the yeast prior to its full fermentation, leaving behind residual sugar in the industry known as RS, right? And so, which of course we test for, because we don't want you drinking sugar. But I believe sugar is public enemy number one for health. And so that's how wines are made. Now let's talk about the yeast for a moment. Here's what we don't know, because no one's funded any study around this. We do not know what these genetically modified commercial yeast are doing to you and your body and your mind. We don't know.
Right.
Here's what we do know. When we're not using them, you feel better.
Yep.
Right. So we just, there's no research. I can't tell you what commercial yeast are doing. I don't know. Here's what we do know is that when we remove the additives and we use a native yeast that's indigenous, it's on the skin of every grape. When we allow wine to make itself naturally, we don't have any of these issues and problems. I mean, I'd love to be able to give you some science studies on the effects of commercial yeast. They just don't exist.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and I get that, but let me tell you something. What we know about GMO, none of it's good. We know that there's potential problems all over the place, even with our microbiome, so I'm sure it's a big reason why we don't feel as well. But like I said, I'm sure the studies will come eventually. But right now, I just want to avoid it. You know, let's shift gears. You have a book coming out, man, or, you know, it's the keto. You've been keto 3 years, changed your world. Intermittent fasting, I always say it was the thing that I changed over, and at 51 had the greatest impact. Well, it's been a few years now doing intermittent fasting, probably about three, almost four, but you know, had the greatest impact on my health out of anything I ever did. So how did you find ketosis? How did you find intermittent fasting, and what effect have they had on you?
Well, I discovered ketosis and the ketogenic diet, like most people do, not everyone, but like most people, to break through a weight loss plateau, right? So I first experimented with ketosis, not understanding the ketogenic diet at all, in the 1980s. Yeah. With the Atkins diet.
Sure.
Right? So you might recall in the original Atkins book, I mean, he was a proponent of reaching ketosis, and this is before – you know, it was as sophisticated or well understood as it is today. And we, you know, he suggested using, you know, the urine sticks at that time to kind of see if we know now that once you become fat adaptive and you're metabolically adjusted to burning fat, that the urine sticks are no longer really accurate. And blood testing is the gold standard for the measurement of ketones. So I had been experimenting with low carb diets over the years, but I decided to experiment about 3 years ago with ketosis to break through kind of a weight loss plateau. I thought I had like just 5 more pounds I just personally wanted to lose that I couldn't seem to shake. In fact, after I became ketogenic, I lost almost an additional 20 pounds over the ensuing years that I really had no idea that I really needed to lose. But here's been my experience with ketosis. You know, most people begin to break through a weight loss plateau, but in fact, I continued, and the reason that I'm a proponent and an evangelist for the ketogenic diet today is really its effect on the reduction of inflammation. Okay. So you can even look in the face of someone who's ketogenic, everybody on my staff is ketogenic. It's not a requirement of working here. It just happens to be who we are. And most of the folks who work for me are younger and happen to be quite thin. And even when they be ketogenic, they didn't experience much weight loss, but what you could really see is a restructuring in their face. This tremendous kind of melting away of puffiness that's even apparent. You don't even realize it's there, particularly for people who are thin by nature. You don't really see them as inflamed. But in fact, when they become ketogenic, you see this kind of melting away, and you'll see a more defined facial structure, right? That's inflammation. And that was an amazing result. So for me, the problem with the ketogenic movement at the moment is that even among health experts talk about how difficult it is to be on a ketogenic diet, and I just don't feel that way. It's a luxurious way to eat.
Nah.
I mean, it's exceptionally delicious and luxurious. And so I think we really, and what my cookbook is really showing is, look, this is a magnificent and pleasurable and delicious way to live. Right? And you're not actually depriving yourself of anything other than some poisons.
Where do we get your cookbook, man? Give us
Like everything else, you know, we just never on schedule. You know, we're just always constantly in a struggle. We're super busy this year. Our business grew like 100x because we sell these healthy wines that people just seem to want to drink a lot of. right? So we've just been kind of busy. Let's talk about fasting for just a second before we wrap up, because I have to agree with you. Intermittent fasting for me was probably, it was so profound when I discovered it. I wanted to share with your listeners, for those, many of them I'm sure are doing intermittent fasting, and the Lean Gains method, the 16 to 18 hour fast and two feedings in a 6 hour window, is the most popular fasting regimen, and the one I followed for 2.5 years or so. 6 or 8 months ago, maybe it's been a little longer than that now, I adapted a single feeding a day, doing a 24-hour fast every day, 22 to 24 hours. I had the most profound impact when I went to a single feeding a day. I hate to use the word feeding. It sounds so clinical, but because I don't see.
You're like this.
Yeah, single feeding. I have such a romantic relationship with food that I hate to call it feeding, because I just.
Let me give you a tip. One meal a day.
One meal a day. It's been the most.
Up again.
Once I went to a 1 meal a day program on the 20, I got new power, best at the gym. I got boom, you know. So it's like I had my personal best on both high intensity training as well as resistance training for weightlifting. My personal best after I went to today. I thought I might experience just the opposite. I thought I might experience some lean body loss or a loss of power, not having that fuel. In fact, just the opposite happened. And yeah, I work out in the mornings in a fasted state.
You know, I think the way you went about it is right, because some people, you know, we're dealing with sick people, right? And they struggle even at 14 hours, and then all of a sudden that gets easier. Then all of a sudden they can do 18, then 20. You know, I do probably 2 to 3 days a week where I eat 24 hour dinner to dinner. So 1 meal a day, 1 feeding a day when they take me from the barn and they give me. I assure you it's not oats. It's more grass related. But anyways, but you know what? I'm telling you, Todd, I agree. You become so hormonally optimized with the rise in growth hormone. I mean, how many studies did I read, right, Meredith, at the seminar? You know, it really is amazing. However, you know, it takes people some time to get there. When people try it right away, they throw the baby out with the bathwater because their mitochondria are so damaged. So they're mitochondria inefficient. Just simply can't do it right away. But we have our methods. We have our methods. And then, you know, I'll tell you, Todd, you know, what's magic for me is, you know, at least 1 day a week where I actually purposely do eat more. It reminds our bodies that it's not starving, you know, and we know that the body will hang on to that fat. You know, because it becomes that precious. And just that 1 day feast cycle, which, you know, I wrote an article called Diet Variation. You know, it really is just emulating or imitating our ancestors and what they did, what they were forced to do. So I'm with you, Todd. I mean, just powerful stuff hormonally changes, and you do become more anabolic and lean all at the same time.
If my advice and counsel to people is really to kind of ease into fasting. And also, if you practice a ketogenic diet, once you become fat adaptive and you're burning fat as your primary fuel source, fasting becomes so, so much easier. If you're a glucose burner, fasting can be really tough. Your brain's demanding fuel.
No doubt. When you go into ketosis, you're supposed to release upon fat burning something called cholecystathionine, which cholecystathionine actually tells your body that it's not hungry. And you just kind of don't have to eat. It's easier to fast, right? But let me tell you something, folks, though. The key is feasting in the evening, making sure you eat enough. Because if you try to caloric restrict by saying, okay, I'm going to eat less even for my dinner, your body's going to think it's starving. It's going to shut off all the fat burning. So not a good idea. So feast like our ancestors. Have a good glass of wine or two, right? Or three, for that matter. Todd, come on. You drink with your wines. You can drink a bottle, for goodness sakes.
I drink a bottle every night.
That's
Microdosing, Todd.
That is microdosing, but it's we've lowered the inherent amount of alcohol. And when I say drink a bottle, so we'll start, you know, at dinner, and I eat on the early side because I'm fasted. I usually eat between 6 and 7 at night. So we're going to, you know, we're going to start there. I don't usually drink without eating because I'm fasted, right? I don't want like a jolt of alcohol to my brain. So I'm going to eat with a meal, and then that, you know, drinking a bottle of wine will go on for 3 or 4 or 5 hours, you know, before I go to bed. I mean, it's not like just sit down and hammer a bottle back, but it's, you know, it's a gradual process and there's food involved. And so that's mitigating part of the absorption. And, you know,
you raise a good point though. So we're talking about, you know, one meal a day. You know, when we look at our ancestors, when we look at the Romans and the Greeks and so many other cultures, right, the Hebrews, I mean, they had this one big meal a day where they sat down, but it lasted 2-3 hours. I mean, Europe still is that way more, right? I mean, it's this slow process of eating and feasting. So, you know, I mean, it's amazing what happens in that process. Your body doesn't think it's starving. So what does it burn all day long through the night? Fat. It burns it. You want to live longer, you stabilize your glucose and insulin. The only real way to do it is not eating. Every time you eat, even if it's a salad, you spike your insulin and glucose,
absolutely,
right? You know, we have a saying on Cell TV, don't eat less, eat less often. And that's the key to living longer, man. Eat less often.
That's right. The other thing that you see in when you talk about this longer dining period, this is about a cultural value too. This is how stories are shared.
Yes.
This is how love is created. Right. And the one thing we can all do to make the world a better place, or as we say here, how can we be the change we want to see in the world?
Yeah.
And the way we can be the change we want to see is to spread more love. And there's no better place than the dinner table to spread that love.
Absolutely.
Right. And to touch people you're with.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're eating too often and we're in too big of a hurry.
Man, I'll tell you, and add a little of the wine, right? The good stuff. And it just, I'm telling you, it's good for your adrenals. It's good for this. It's good for your life. I mean, you know, yeah, we know the French and all these cultures that live long, you know, healthy without heart disease. They drink some wine. Our Lord and Savior drank wine. I mean, come on. You know, it's part of the culture. It's what man has done to wine, just like meat, just like dairy, just like wheat. You know, everything we've ruined, you know, commercialized, you know, wine is no different. We've made bad for man. Let's go back to the old way, right, Todd? So, hey, I want to throw a caution out there because, you know, some people think that they eat one meal a day or two meals a day, but when you look at it closer, they don't consider this, the handful of nuts or the scoop of coconut oil is a meal oftentimes, right? It's like, but they're doing these things all day long. They don't realize it. You know, it's like, give your body a break. You know, truly fast and truly eat and enjoy what you're saying.
Yeah, no question about it. So it's, I'm sure many of your listeners are already on fasting regimens, but it, you know, it's, you know, the, it's one of the greatest biohacks of all time.
Yeah.
Right. No, and it's natural. It's ancestrally correct. We know that.
Yeah.
I mean, we know for 2.5 million years, sapiens have been walking around. It's only been a couple of thousand years, arguably the agricultural revolution was just 10,000 years ago, right? But, you know, before the last 100 or 200 years, I mean, even we had more regular intermittent fasting because people didn't have regular access to food.
Absolutely.
And if we look back prior to 10,000 years ago, it was a daily practice. Sometimes people went multiple days without eating.
Right? And then that's the thing. We call block fasting here on Cell TV where, you know, one or two fasts a year, just like that. And for patients getting their health back, oftentimes we have to fast them once a month or every other month. But, you know, 4 or 5 days, I'll tell you what, without food, watch what happens. You know what? The Hunza people did it every spring. They called it Starvation Spring. The American Indians did it. I mean, all of these tribes did it. Sometimes they were forced to, but it also became, you know, something that they just planned on because they knew that these gaps were coming and they wanted to, you know, get their harvest ready, etc. They fasted. Humans are meant to fast. It's healing. Animals do it instinctively. We're trying to teach y'all to do it.
Awesome. Awesome.
Hey, Todd, thank you. And I'll turn it back over to Meredith to close us out.
Well, thank you guys so much. I didn't expect to be totally re-inspired to fast from this show, but now I really am. So awesome information. And Todd, you have such a generous offer for our listeners. If you guys go to Dry Farm Wines, and it's winesplural.com/Dr. Pompa, that's DrPompa, you will get a bottle of Dry Farm Wines for one penny. So yeah, check that out. Yeah, Dr. Pompa, you can go to your own URL and get one.
I love Todd. I tell you, this guy is, I love him. Let's just keep having him on just so we can keep getting a bottle of wine for a darn penny. Hey, we'll have you back on when we do your cookbook, man. You know, when you get that sucker out there. All right, Todd, we appreciate you. We appreciate you.
Hey, listen, thanks for having me on the show today. It's just an awesome time. Also, if any listeners want to contact me direct, it's just Todd, T-O-D-D, at dryfarmwines.com, and promise to answer your emails. And also, I want to say to all of you and to your audience, I love you. Thank you so much for having me on today. Spread lots of love throughout the world every chance you can, and spend more time eating with your friends.
Yeah, we love you too, Todd. Thank you, man.
Amen.
All right, take care.
Thanks for watching.
Bye.
Enjoy your healthy wine, and we'll see you next week.